From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we ask several journalists for their analysis of the O.J. Simpson verdict. First, we'll talk with Stephen Adler about what the trial says about the jury system. Adler is the author of the book The Jury and is the investigative editor of The Wall Street Journal. He thinks that race often influences the verdict in contemporary jury trials. Brent Staples is an editorial writer at the New York Times. Today's Times editorial focused on how the Los Angeles Police Department bungled the collection of evidence. Jim Krogan has been writing about the LAPD for several years. He reported on the Simpson trial for the LA Weekly and Newsweek. Analysis of the Simpson verdict coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Weather forecasters say Hurricane Opal is a little more than 100 miles off the coast of Pensacola, Florida. Hurricane warnings are posted from the mouth of the Mississippi River to just outside Tampa, Florida. The National Hurricane Center is warning Opal will strike land today. Wind gusts have been as strong as 185 miles per hour. Bill Oberst of member station WKGC in Panama City, Florida, says many residents are trying to get out, but they can't.
We understand there's just complete gridlock. The Highway Patrol is shutting off Highway 231, which is an evacuation route. They're shutting the southbound traffic to make all four lanes northbound. And we understand that about 60 miles up the road, when we run into Interstate 10, which intersects 231, the traffic is backing up there en route to Tallahassee. So we've got a lot of traffic problems. A lot of people waited too long and are trying to get out of here now.
Bay County Commissioner John Robbins is coordinating hurricane preparations.
We've had a lot of practice this year with this. This is the fourth storm this year that we've had to prepare for. The emergency center activated last evening, and we began to ask for volunteer evacuation last night. Some people took advantage of that and left early, but the majority of the folks waited until today. And we now have a large portion of the population of our area seems to be leaving.
Hundreds of Florida police and National Guardsmen are on alert. Georgia and Alabama residents are also going to shelters or fortifying their homes. Alabama Governor Bob James closed all state schools, issued a mandatory evacuation order for low-lying areas, and he put all 67 counties on a state of emergency. Opal is being compared to the devastating storm Camille. That storm ravaged the Mississippi coast in 1969. The mercenary who overthrew the Comoro government is refusing to surrender to French commandos who have stormed the African island. French officials had reported mercenary Bob Denard had given himself up to French troops, but he has released the Comoro president, Saïd Mohamed Johar. About 600 camouflaged French commandos landed at the Comoro airport today with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns. The French Defense Ministry also says more commandos swarmed ashore on inflatable speedboats and battled Comorian soldiers. NATO officials say NATO warplanes fired missiles at three Bosnian Serb radar sites today. A spokesman says the missiles were fired after the radar locked onto the planes. Attacks were for three separate incidents. This is the first NATO air attack on Bosnian Serb targets since September 20th. That's when the alliance announced a stop to 2 weeks of airstrikes on the Serbs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 6 points at 47.42. This is NPR. Russia's foreign minister reminded the West again today that Russia is still opposed to NATO expansion. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports from Moscow.
As he left on an official visit to NATO member Norway, Andrei Kozyrev said NATO plans to take in Russia's former allies in Central and Eastern Europe could lead to increased friction, suspicion, and talk of retaliatory measures. Russia's leaders have recently hinted Moscow may try to set up a new military alliance of some of the former Soviet republics as a defensive measure. And according to a Russian newspaper report, Moscow would consider moving troops into the Baltic states should they become members of the NATO alliance. Despite this, Lithuania today repeated its determination to join NATO. The Lithuanian foreign minister has called in the Russian ambassador demanding a clarification of the Russian report. Today, Russian Foreign Minister Kozyrev denied rumors of a new Russian military doctrine. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
Former futures trader Nicholas Leeson will go back to Singapore. A German court authorized his extradition on fraud, forgery, and breach of trust charges. Leeson is the trader blamed for the collapse of Barings Bank, Britain's oldest investment bank. He's alleged to have carried out risky deals while he worked in Singapore. Singaporean authorities have pressed for his return, and Leeson's attorney says the German court approved extradition on 11 of 12 charges. Leeson was trying to get home to England when he was stopped and arrested in Germany. The government says factory orders jumped 2.6% in August. The biggest increase in 9 months was led by automobile production. Orders to factories are an essential check of how well the nation's manufacturing sector is doing. The Commerce Department says these orders are running 7.7% higher this year than they did for the first 8 months of last year. The government also says the index of leading economic indicators rose 0.2% in August. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One day after the Simpson verdict, Americans are analyzing what the trial reveals about the courts, the police, race, and class in America. We'll be hearing the analysis of several journalists today. Stephen Adler is the author of the book The Jury, Disorder in the Court, a critique of what's wrong with the jury system and how to fix it. Adler is the former legal editor of The Wall Street Journal. He's now the journal's investigative editor. He edited today's front-page story on the Simpson verdict. The headline reads, "Colorblinded? Race seems to play an increasing role in many jury verdicts." We phoned Stephen Adler earlier today and asked him to summarize the article.
We looked at what appears to be the increasing role of race in many jury verdicts around the country. We intentionally didn't focus on the O.J. Simpson case, which is atypical in so many ways. And we looked at statistics on acquittal rates. We looked at a number of particular cases. And we talked to prosecutors and jurors and defense lawyers. And what we found is that there appears to be increasing concern, particularly among black jurors, that the system is stacked against them, that police are racist, that they're likely to lie on the witness stand. And we found that many black jurors are looking at evidence differently as a result, that they're much more likely than white jurors to distrust police evidence, to distrust the prosecution broadly, and that, in fact, in many cases, they're rationally applying their life experiences, which is what jurors are supposed to do. It's just simply that their life experiences are very different from those of many white jurors. But we also found that some black jurors were taking this a step further, and that they were determining that it was better sometimes to acquit a black defendant, even though they knew that person was guilty, because there were too many blacks in prison in their communities, the system in general wasn't fair, and that they simply did not want to put, as some said, any more young black men in jail. In that sense, they were exercising what people who write about jurors call jury nullification. They were going against the law, and they were doing it quite consciously.
Give me an example of a case where that happened.
Well, the interesting thing is that you can often see that it happened because the evidence is so overwhelming that there's no explanation, and that, in fact, jury scholars and black jury analysts will say very clearly that this had to be nullification. But jurors almost never say they're doing that. They understand or they have a sense that they're not supposed to, and they either won't discuss the case or they'll state some sort of evidentiary reason. And many years ago, the kind of best study that's ever been done of juries at the University of Chicago looked at this phenomenon generally. They said the jury does not often consciously and explicitly yield to sentiment in the teeth of the law. Rather, it yields to sentiment in the apparent process of resolving doubts as to evidence. The jury, therefore, is able to conduct its revolt from the law within the etiquette of resolving issues of fact. That seems to me to be happening much more often than a jury simply saying that that they don't care about the facts. However, we did look at a case. It was a case of a defendant named Darryl Smith in Washington in 1990, where he was acquitted by an all-black jury in a murder case, and a letter came from an anonymous juror to the court after the case. And the letter said that most jurors in the case believed that Mr. Smith was guilty, but the majority bowed to holdouts who, according to the letter, quote, didn't want to send any more young black men to jail, end quote. That's about as explicit as it gets.
Why did you decide to go with the issue of race on this day, the day after the O.J. Simpson verdict?
Well, race was clearly a major issue in this case. It's one that has already been discussed at great length. If it wasn't discussed before the Furman tapes, it was certainly pervasive afterwards. It's an issue that, in some sense, what happens in the jury room is echoing or shining a light on what's happening outside. And it's important in that way. The point of the story is not to say that black jurors don't know how to follow the law or that they're lawless or that something kind of dangerous or incendiary is going on. It's saying that, as jurors have always done in our country, black jurors seem to be calling out from the jury room about things going on in society, and these are things that the rest of society needs to hear. And again, without passing value judgment on whether they should or shouldn't be doing this, we wanted to look at the fact that it does appear to be occurring. If you just look at the acquittal rates in the Bronx in New York, which is heavily black and Hispanic, 47% of felony defendants are acquitted. Nearly half are let go, whereas nationally the acquittal rate is about 17%. So, and this seems to be holding in many heavily black urban areas. So we thought it was a very important issue. It was an issue that was out there, and that if we could kind of take a balanced, thoughtful look at why it's happening, what it means, and again, not take sides, but look at it in some context, that it would actually be worth entering into the conversation that we know is going on today. The point of the tradition is very important. I mean, we have a tradition where, for example, in the 19th century, there was a fugitive slave law, which many northern juries opposed, that said that it was against the law to harbor a slave. And many northern juries refused to convict people who were harboring slaves. They simply nullified that law by refusing to convict. It happened during Prohibition, where many people were against Prohibition, and they started refusing to convict bootleggers. And that had a big impact on the repeal of Prohibition. Fascinating, during the Vietnam War, you can look at charts, and as the opposition to the war increased, the conviction rates of draft evaders went down. Jury is one of the kind of branches of government. It's one of the places where the people directly put a brake on things going on laws that they don't approve of. It's one of the many sort of checks and balances in the system.
Well, how does that apply to the Simpson trial? I mean, people don't approve of murder. No one's trying to challenge the idea that murder is a bad thing, that murder should remain illegal.
Right, but what jury nullification is either a protest against a particular law or a protest against the way the law is being applied or the way the government is behaving in the particular case. In this case, if jury nullification was occurring, I think it was occurring because of the feeling that there were too many racist police involved in the case, that the system in general in Los Angeles was skewed against black people, that black people were being victimized by the system, and it was obviously helped along by the fact that there was sloppy police work, that sometimes the prosecution was not that effective. But I think it's impossible to look at this case intelligently without recognizing how important race was in the case. All you have to do is look at the polls. This is an unusual case because the public was actually very, very, very well aware of the issues. People were watching it very closely. They were watching it on television. I've talked to some 10-year-old children who understood this case better than I did. I mean, it's really part of the culture, and I think people were seeing getting a pretty fair look of what was really going on in the courtroom. And yet, at the end of the trial, it was something like 70% of whites thought he was guilty and 70% of blacks thought he wasn't. It's not surprising that a jury, filtering the evidence through their own life experiences, would see it differently also. So I think it's a combination of particularly distrusting the prosecution and also being angry. I mean, just being angry at the sense that blacks aren't being treated well. And you put those two together and you get what the University of Chicago was saying, that there is a revolt from the law that's happening within the etiquette of evaluating the evidence.
Is it presumptuous to assume that there was something racial going on in the jury room when they were deliberating? For instance, today one of the jurors, Lon Cryer, said that the reason for the verdict was scientific. It wasn't about race, and that the reason why they wanted to rehear testimony from the limo driver, Alan Park, is that finally they decided that
the number of cars he said he saw in the driveway was inaccurate, and that called into question the rest of his testimony.
Well, we had an 8 or 9 month trial, and what you really have to think about is how each of these jurors evaluated the evidence during the 8 or 9 months of trial, and through what prism, through what perspective as to how the world works that they looked at this evidence. It seems to me that if you were not tremendously suspicious of the process and of the system, that the DNA evidence would by and large be overwhelming, and that the combination of coincidences you would have to show to indicate that he didn't do it would be just so overwhelming, just independently, that there was that size shoe and there was so much blood and there was a trail of blood and there was the hat and the fibers and there was the question about his whereabouts, and there was the fact that the jurors couldn't exclude from their minds that there was never any showing of possible showing of anybody else's involvement. And I just think if you looked at all of the different pieces of it and the history of spouse abuse, unless you were being influenced by life experiences that made you very, very suspicious of the whole presentation, of the whole combination of messages that the prosecution was starting to send, that you would probably see the evidence taken together as tremendously strong. Also, looking inside the jury room, if it's true that the initial vote was 10-2 to acquit, just past studies of juries make it really clear that a 10-2 to acquit on the first ballot is virtually always a unanimous verdict, that one or two people almost never hold out against the 10 who are in the majority. So it doesn't sound to me as if there was much deliberation. It sounded as if 10 people were very sure when they came in there, and that's really sufficient to get an acquittal, just the way group dynamics work and the usual unwillingness of a small group of people to hold out against a large group of people.
Well, you know, yesterday the daughter of one of the jurors said that her mother was in tears, saying that she thinks O.J. Simpson actually committed the murders, but the evidence was compromised, so she had to vote not guilty.
Well, again, I mean, I do think there's certainly room for disagreement on the evidence. On the other hand, even if some pieces of evidence in a case are compromised, it seems to me that the fact is that police often do help a case along where they believe the defendant is guilty, but they also do some inappropriate things, and that my sense is that may even have happened in this case, and it may have been that the jury needed to put aside certain pieces of evidence and say that they're tainted, but to leap from that to a decision not to accept some incredibly strong DNA evidence and a powerful combination of circumstantial evidence that's very hard to explain away as part of any one conspiracy or any one kind of pervasive pattern of sloppiness. I think if you're going to explain all of that away, you have to do it within the context of having tremendous ongoing suspicion of what it is the authorities are going to tell you. When this case started, people were talking about what kind of juror does the defense need, what kind of juror does the prosecution need, and it seemed to me at the time that the most important thing you wanted on the defense were jurors who were suspicious of authority, who just thought that people out there, either because they were experts or because they were part of the government or because of their race, were not of them, that these were people from the outside who were doing things to them and they couldn't be trusted. And I think you have to have watched this case through that prism in order to reach a not guilty verdict. And again, I'm not saying in some broader sense necessarily that that's right or wrong. People are supposed to evaluate evidence through their own life experiences. And I think it says a lot about the different life experiences of blacks and whites that they see this case so differently.
How do you interpret the incredibly swift decision that the jury reached?
Well, as soon as I heard the decision was so fast, I was almost sure it was an acquittal. And the reason for that is if you're certain that somebody is not guilty, then you have a really good reason to want to report back quickly. If you feel as if somebody has been in prison unfairly for a very long period of time, you don't want any of that on your conscience. And so if the fact is if 10 people were sure at the beginning and the other two were willing to relent relatively quickly, I can really see how the jury would want to get back and set Simpson free, because that's what they feel their job is. Of course, they're in a hurry to get out also, but I don't really think that was the factor in this case. I think if there had been a real dispute in the case, they would have argued it out. But here, so many of them had made their decision long ago, and they just felt it wasn't fair to the defendant to have him continue being in prison.
My guest is Stephen Adler, investigative editor of The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Adler, author of the book The Jury, Disorder in the Court. You've done a lot of post-trial interviews with jury members. What would you like to ask the jury members of the Simpson trial now?
I think I'd like to ask them how they could see each of these separate pieces of evidence as all tainted. And I'd be interested in when they decided that there was nothing about this case they could, about the prosecution's case they could take seriously. Because I think what happened was, because of either a general sense that people were lying, or a general suspicion of authorities, they didn't look at all of the evidence together and ask the question, what are the odds that each and every piece of evidence that's out there that seems to point to the defendant would be out there if he wasn't guilty. What always struck me about this case was that you kind of had to multiply the probabilities. What are the probabilities that he would happen to be bleeding at that time? What is the probability that there'd happen to be a hat with fibers that matched his? What's the probability that the blood would be in all the different places and it would match his? You just had to, what would be the probability that a particular size shoe would happen to be there and he happened to have that size shoe? What would be the probability that he had owned a couple of pairs of gloves that would clearly seem to be the same type of glove, a very rare glove that was found at the scene? So even if you had a problem with any one of them, it struck me that sort of a sophisticated way to look at the case was to try to multiply the probabilities that each of those would independently be out there, and yet somehow he wasn't the person who did it. And I kind of like to get into their thought process on all the separate pieces of evidence and see just how they looked at that.
What is the equation, though, you're supposed to use between the kind of probability that you're talking about and reasonable doubt?
Well, I mean, I think the defense was extremely effective in saying, essentially, if any of this evidence is tainted, you can't trust any of it. That would not be my own, as a juror, that would be not be my way of looking at the case. People have written treatises on what is reasonable doubt and how certain do you have to be. And if you look at it in terms of probability, how certain do you have to be? But I think if you think it's 1,000 to 1, that's passes the test of reasonable doubt. And again, you can look at it mathematically, or you can look at it just kind of what your gut says. But I think if you say this is a coincidence almost beyond imagining, and I see nothing pointing in the other direction, then you kind of have to convict. I think what this jury first of all said, if any evidence is tainted, it may all be tainted. And secondly, they screened it all through a general sense that the system was unfair, that it was operating both sloppily and aggressively racist, in an aggressively racist way, and that they simply wouldn't be comfortable believing the whole collection of evidence that the prosecution put forward. But if you look at the polls again, I think most white people looking at that would see it the other way. And again, this is a window on the racial divide in just how we see the world, and it's very important. And I think people is the one thing that can clearly be learned about this. Is that these feelings are extremely widespread, that they cross class lines, that I talk to African American colleagues and they'll just see the case very differently from the way I will, and I think it's important for us to understand that.
Do you think that the defense manipulated racial identity and racial loyalty in this case?
Yes, but frankly, they didn't really need to. It was there. I thought that the The jury heard plenty of the Furman tapes, for example. The notion that they needed to hear more of the tapes to understand what was going on, I thought was nonsense. There were three witnesses bolstering the fact that he'd used the word. There were the snippets of the tapes. It was just really clear. Nobody had to point a finger at it. I think it was that Johnny Cochran obviously took it further than many people, including Robert Shapiro, thought was appropriate, but I really didn't think that that mattered. I think the jury knew long before closing arguments where they stood in the case, and they knew long before closing arguments that they thought there was something fundamentally racist about the way the case was presented.
So you're getting the message that right now race really is playing a pretty major part and how juries decide the outcome of criminal cases. So what do you take away from that? I mean, do you think that means the jury system needs to be reformed, or is that just a sign of how racist America has been, and this is what it's led to? I mean, what's your interpretation of?
Well, a couple of things. I think that again, most jurors are trying to look at the evidence and trying to decide the case based on the evidence, and that's true whether they're black or white. So there could be improvement in the jury system that would simply strengthen the presentation of evidence, make it easier for the jurors to look clearly at the evidence, and that in some ways you might end up to some degree limiting the racial impact. For example, if you chose juries more from a cross-section of the community rather than trying to weight the jury using jury consultants towards people who might favor one side or the other, you probably end up with better results. If you have shorter trials so jurors can really focus and more people from more walks of life can participate as jurors, you might kind of get more fact-based verdicts. If you don't have lengthy sequestrations, which tend to make juries angry at the prosecution, you might get better verdicts. So that's just kind of jury system kind of stuff. But I think more broadly, we're just looking at the racial divide in the country. I think we have to acknowledge that it's much greater than some people have been willing to admit. If there's any message, it's that unless the police are perceived as less racist, unless the system as a whole is perceived as less racist, you're going to have this this message being sent out of the jury room that it's not that the jury system so much has to be fixed, but that things outside have to be fixed. And the jury has always been a very good window on what's going on outside and a very useful one. So to the extent anything positive comes out of this, it's telling people that the problem is really outside the jury room with the way the justice system is functioning and the way the police are functioning, and not so much what happens inside the jury room.
Stephen Adler is the investigative editor of The Wall Street Journal. His book, The Jury, Disorder in the Court, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more analysis of the O.J. Simpson trial. We continue our conversation about juries with Stephen Adler, author of The Jury, and investigative editor for The Wall Street Journal. We'll talk with New York Times editorial writer Brent Staples, and journalist Jim Krogan will tell us why he wasn't surprised by the acquittal. He's been following the case for the L.A. Weekly and has reported on the LAPD for years. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen Adler, author of the book The Jury, Disorder in the Court. He's the investigative editor of The Wall Street Journal and edited today's front-page story on the O.J. Simpson verdict. In your book, The Jury, you write, juries are losing their moral authority. They're selected for their likely partisanship and persuaded by advertising techniques. Any application there that you see to the O.J. trial?
Yes, I do. I mean, again, I think there are really two things going on here. One is the case was set up in such a way as to enable a defendant with a lot of money to steer a case in a certain direction. And then in addition, there was this very real overlay of racial issues in society that were going to affect the jury almost no matter how it was composed, as long as there were a significant number of blacks on the jury. But in this case, I think we have to look first at jury selection and what it tells us about the problems with jury selection. Here they spent weeks and weeks, enormous sums of money, jury consultants on both sides, analyzing how a jury was likely to respond to certain kinds of appeals. The defense knew very well that African-American jurors that they had picked, people who they had selected and wanted on the jury, were likely to react favorably to some of Johnny Cochran's appeals because they had pre-tested this. I've been arguing both in my book and since then that this isn't the way we should pick juries. We shouldn't allow it to be part of a strategic fight to see who can gain advantage. That we really want are people who represent the community, who are broad cross-section. And so my recommendation has been to first of all to make sure we're really reaching out. We're getting lists of people from all sorts of places so that we bring in a cross-section of the community. And then I would pick that jury at random, because it seems to me that everybody's got biases, everybody's got prejudices, that they tend to move in different directions, and that if you have a true cross-sectional jury and you actually get them in and deliberate, that they can balance out each other's preconceptions, they can challenge each other, you'll have a real deliberation, and that perhaps a better verdict will come out. The people who were saying that this is the way to select a jury, I think should now reflect on whether that makes sense.
I think the O.J. Simpson case asked a lot of questions about what we demand of the jury. The jury was sequestered for, I think it was a record amount of time. What was it, like close to 9 months?
Yeah.
Their contact with family and friends was limited to 15-minute phone calls each night. One 15-minute call each night.
I know it was very limited, yeah.
Yeah, the calls were monitored by sheriff's deputies. They had 5-hour conjugal visits on Saturdays. Deputies collected jurors' room keys each night and routinely searched their belongings for diaries or other objects that they weren't supposed to have. Is it reasonable to expect jurors to sacrifice so much to do their duty?
It's entirely unreasonable to ask juries to sacrifice so much, and it's one of the main things that's wrong with the jury system. First of all, it's a main reason we don't have a cross-section of jurors, of people in the community involved in the system, because most people simply could not take this much time out from their lives. But it's also just a statement to jurors that even though they are the ultimate judges in the case, that we don't respect them. We're treating them more the way we treat criminal defendants than the way we would treat a judge. And I think puts outrageous pressure on them. It makes them resentful of the process. They don't feel as if they're part of the judging team. They feel as if they're people who are involved in some sort of ordeal. The simplest way to solve this, I think, is to force trials to be much shorter. I mean, the traditional American jury trial lasted one day. In the last 10 years, the number of trials lasting, I think, 3 weeks or more has more than doubled. Judges are simply losing control of the courtroom. To me, the single worst thing about the way this case played out was how long it was allowed to last. There's no constitutional right to a 9-month trial. Most trials don't take that long, don't need to, but the judge has to exercise his power to set time limits and to push the case along. It was absurd to have these short days earlier in the trial. The legal arguments should never take place during the court day. They should take place before and after the court day. And witnesses can, time limits can be placed on witnesses, lawyers can be cut off, a lawyer can be told you have a day with this witness, period, you don't have to have 9 days of cross-examination. That would not prevent somebody from getting a fair trial. So I think that the thing we really have to reflect on is the absurdity of letting trials go on this long. If this trial had lasted 4 to 6 weeks, which I think was an appropriate length, perhaps you could have sequestered a jury for 4 to 6 weeks without putting too much pressure on them. But in a trial this length, it doesn't make sense.
Stephen Adler is the investigative editor of The Wall Street Journal. His book, The Jury, Disorder in the Court, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded earlier today. The New York Times ran an editorial today about the O.J. Simpson verdict. The editorial acknowledges the considerable scientific and circumstantial evidence incriminating Simpson in the murders. But it says the jury's verdict of not guilty is understandable, given the relentlessly exposed bungling of the Los Angeles Police Department. The editorial concludes, in the end, this will be remembered as a case that was disrupted by the police. Earlier today, we called Brent Staples, an editorial page writer for The New York Times and a member of the editorial board. He's also the author of the memoir Parallel Time. I asked Brent Staples to summarize today's editorial.
Well, I think our editorial essentially said that the police put on an implausible case. And they botched a lot of evidence. And let me just go over it. Actually, we have here. They made several different mistakes. And I think they mishandled evidence. The blood was one case. I think, as Scott Turow pointed out this morning on the op-ed page, the whole episode of the discovery of the glove was implausible as put on by the police. I think that the police evidence was cast into doubt at several junctures. Almost every crucial piece of evidence was cast into doubt. You know? And I think that point we made this morning in the editorial.
So you think that race has been overemphasized in the Simpson case?
Well, I think that the media often resort to race when they don't need it. Okay? Given the poll data this morning, the data that show 35% of white people thought O.J. Simpson innocent, and about 82% of black people. Given those numbers, it is not possible, in most cases, to look at people on the street and know what their judgment about this case is. You see a lot of jubilance in photographs, you know, and a lot of disappointment and shock in photographs, but statistically, it's just not possible to look at people and determine what they think about the case. And unfortunately, race is almost it's the easiest thing to reach for in a situation which involves blacks and whites. Okay, and that is one thing. But also the racial features of this case were clearly prominent. Mark Furman and his famous statements about being willing to falsify evidence, his marked distaste for black people, his overt racism, I think cast the case in more of a racial light than already was there, very clearly. However, even putting aside the Furman testimony, let us put aside for a moment the Furman testimony. This is the exercise you need to do. Put aside the Furman testimony and look at the doubts that were cast about the evidence. Doubts that were cast about how the evidence was collected. You know, doubts that were cast about the motives of the detectives who handled the evidence. These were substantial doubts, even without Furman. And then if we bring Furman back on the stage at this point and understand that the only minute bits of what Furman actually had to say were said to the jury, okay? Furman's remarks about his willingness to falsify evidence where black defendants were concerned, he was very zealous about that point. The jury never even heard that.
I know you were probably up very late last night working on the editorial for The Times, but I don't know how much time you had a chance to watch TV, but every time I put on the TV, I saw images, of like a white restaurant and an African-American restaurant, or, mm-hmm. you know, a white bar and a black bar, a white classroom, an African-American classroom. And the same image kept recurring, you know, in the white venue, people expressed their disappointment or their bafflement. In the African-American venues, people were standing up and cheering after the verdict was delivered. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that, of course, the poll data show that people are racially divided on this case. However, the images of a white restaurant juxtaposed with a black restaurant and the white people sort of sad and morose and the black people cheering is not corroborated by statistics, okay? The poll data show that 35% of whites, more than one in three whites, think of O.J. Simpson as innocent. Now, those images are convenient, but they don't tell the whole story. And it's a chronic issue in the electronic media that they try to tell a story with pictures that requires more than pictures, okay? And you can't let those pictures suffice for the entire story.
Did you feel today when you were going to work or maybe in your office that people were sizing each other up and saying, oh, I bet she thinks he was innocent. I bet he thinks he was guilty. You know what I mean? That
generally speaking, I think that black people who work in largely white environments have always been suspect. I think a good many whites in those environments will look at those black people and say, you know, I think that they're probably thinking as a group that they don't share a lot of our values, they don't share a lot of our opinions and ideas, and a case like this brings that out, you know, and it's very socially unfortunate, and it makes for a kind of social cold war. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I do think also that in many contexts, that black people will be made, in some sense, to suffer for this decision. Let's take, for example, a kid who's walking out of South Central Los Angeles this morning to apply for a job in a mailroom in a law firm or something like that. If you're black in a white context, you know, you are a suspect from the very beginning. Okay, I think people make a lot of presumptions about your motives, a lot of presumptions about your talents, a lot of presumptions about your temperament, a good many presumptions about things you can't be rational about. That's one of the things you often hear. So this adds another element to that, and it becomes even a more pressure-filled environment. I wouldn't be surprised if some blacks who were in pressure-filled white situations didn't pretend that they had an opinion other than the one they have about this.
On this, the day after the O.J. Simpson verdict, can I ask you to review some of the other points that you've made in your pieces that have run on the editorial page in The Times?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think two points. One, well, actually several points. I think one thing I keep hammering away at in my signed pieces is the extent to which police wrongdoing is qualitatively different because it must metastasizes in the worst ways throughout the culture. We are struggling in this country to maintain order in cities and maintain order in lawless communities. Every time a group of rogue cops is shown to have lied or framed people or broken the law, it undermines what's already a very difficult effort for us.
I don't know if you feel at liberty to say this as a journalist and editorial writer, but do you think that O.J. Simpson was guilty of murder?
I don't feel at liberty to say that.
That's fine.
And I don't. My job is to render kind of reasonable opinions about the process. And let's just say that what you're asking me. Many people in this country now will feel that some miscarriage of justice has been done. That is very clear. I mean, one has to acknowledge that. The poll records show that many people in this country will feel that a miscarriage of justice has been done. But riddle me this. In your town, you probably have, I don't know, you may even have scores of people who were sent to jail illegally.
You're talking about Philadelphia, where I live, yeah.
In Philadelphia, you have scores of people who were probably sent to jail on trumped-up evidence by the police, falsified evidence. In San Francisco this week, there was a case of a young man who was sent to jail for rape, wrongly accused of rape, and spent 11 years in jail before he was exonerated and shown to be innocent and finally released. That's 11 years of his life. There are many miscarriages of justice in this culture, many, many miscarriages of justice. And for people who think that O.J. Simpson was guilty and it was a miscarriage of justice, I think what we need to do is broaden the scope to look at all of what people consider to be miscarriages of justice and evaluate them all. You know, there are many of them. And they come back to haunt us in strange ways.
Any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
Yes, race was an element in this trial, okay? But even without the element of race, the evidence was badly handled, and the jury saw that. When race is also brought in and placed on top of that, the evidentiary misconduct becomes, in the jury's mind, overwhelming. You know, and it takes them 4 hours to say, fine, let's get out of here. The prosecutors have no case. Two, I think that people who are worried that there was some miscarriage of justice need to take a look not just at this case, but at the system as a whole, okay, at cases where, in fact, people are wrongly accused and put in jail or have their rights abridged by rogue police departments, you know, because those things will come back to haunt us when those people become jurors, when those people have to participate in the criminal justice system in any number of ways, that you know, police misconduct is an extremely socially corrosive element that we have to get some kind of handle on.
Brent Staples is an editorial writer at the New York Times. He's also author of the memoir Parallel Time. This is Fresh Air. Freelance journalist Jim Krogan lives in L.A. and has covered the LAPD for several years. He reported on the Simpson trial for the L.A. Weekly and Newsweek. He says he wasn't surprised by the jury's not guilty verdict. He says there are fundamental questions about much of the evidence against Simpson.
This is the first time that I've ever run across a case where it seemed to me that every piece of what was considered critical or vital evidence had problems attached to it, either in the way it was collected, questions about who collected it, questions about when it was collected, where it was collected, what was done with it, how was it stored, how was it secured, how was it tested. It was really astounding. I started out thinking that there's something really wrong here in terms of it being so sloppy. And then as time wore on and as I got more into uncovering these questions about the evidence, I thought that this isn't sloppiness. There's something wrong here. And when Henry Lee was the doctor, I'm sure your listeners are going to be familiar with him, that he was one of the last defense witnesses, testified and repeated that phrase, that there's something wrong here. That's something that I have felt all the way through this investigation. There's something really wrong here, and people aren't getting to the bottom of this.
If you were a juror in the trial, how do you think you would have evaluated the evidence?
I would have probably voted exactly the way that this jury came back voting. Some concrete examples. For example, the glove, the glove that Detective Mark Furman, former Detective Mark Furman, reportedly found at Rockingham, the right-hand glove. That was found in the early morning of the 13th, and it wasn't booked into evidence until the 16th. Now, they say it was at SID, which is Scientific Investigation Division, during those 3 days. My question to them is, prove that. Prove where it was. And if you don't have it booked into evidence, you really don't have the ability to do that. Detective Van Adder picks up the blood of O.J. takes the blood of O.J. Simpson that was taken down at Parker Center, which is the police headquarters here in Los Angeles, and could have walked downstairs and booked that blood into evidence, which is what he should have done because, according to the LAPD manual, you're supposed to book blood evidence as quickly as possible because you want to refrigerate it to keep it from breaking down. So he could have walked downstairs and done that. He could have driven a mile to Scientific Investigation Division over at Piper Tech. Instead, he chose to drive all the way across town and hand-deliver it to the criminalist out at O.J. Simpson's house at Rockingham. So you can go right down the line with the major items of evidence, and you will find questions about who picked it up, where it was picked up, where was it stored, was it secured, who had access to it. And so sitting on the jury has some of these things, and all of it, truthfully, all of it was not gotten into in this trial, all the questions. And the DA's office and the LAPD have to share and shoulder the responsibility for how this case went. They can't lay it off on race. They can't lay it off on Mark Furman. They can't lay it off on the defense team. They are the ones who put this case together. They are the ones who have the responsibility to make their case. They are the ones who have the responsibility to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. They did not do that, and they lost the case.
You had said that as you looked into this more and more, you reached the conclusion these aren't mistakes. There's something wrong here. What do you think was wrong?
Well, you know, that's my question now. I mean, I don't see this investigation over, or it certainly shouldn't be over. I mean, I asked this yesterday when I was at the press conference that the DA's office was having. I asked DA Gil Garcetti, now that this verdict is in, are they going to go back and reopen this case from square one and go over everything? And he kind of hammered and hawed and stuttered, and then the lights went out, and he said, well, the lights went out on that question, and no, we felt the evidence was strong, and ultimately they're not going to do, they're essentially not going to do that. Now, I think that the reason for that is there's also a real concern in the city, and it comes up every time we have a case where there are questions raised about the conduct of the police or the evidence or the conduct of the DA's office, and that is civil liability. If they did an investigation and found and proved that there was deliberate police misconduct involved in this investigation, I can't even imagine the size of the civil suit that would be facing the city. So I just don't see them. I just don't see them doing it. You know, I don't even see them looking at this issue about notification of Simpson. I don't think there's a reporter in town, and certainly not a reporter who covered this case. Even a reporter who ardently believes that O.J. Simpson is guilty and that he got away with murder. There's not a reporter who covered this case that believes that the LAPD went to Rockingham that night to notify him about the death of his ex-wife. You don't send four detectives and at least one patrol car to do that. The Goldmans, my understanding, my investigation was notified by a clerk at the coroner's office. There's something radically wrong here, and I don't see either the DA's office or the city attorney's office or the LAPD trying to get to the bottom of it. Now, with word coming out of Washington that they're going to, Department of Justice is going to take a look at police misconduct, maybe there's an opportunity there. But somewhere along the line, if government wants to have people believe in it, if law enforcement wants people to have faith in it, if district attorneys want juries to trust it, they've got to take on these questions, and they've got to get to the bottom of this stuff.
Jim Croghan is a freelance journalist based in Los Angeles. He reported on the Simpson trial for the LA Weekly and Newsweek. Well, a whole industry grew around the O.J. Simpson trial. New talk shows were created with the sole purpose of interviewing O.J. spinmeisters. So what's left to talk about now? Well, I received a fax today with this suggestion. National Depression Screening Day is coming up on Thursday, and a certain psychiatrist specializing in depression and loss would like to talk about how people addicted to the trial can deal with withdrawal. The fax concludes by saying, the bottom line is, someone is bound to do this topic. It might as well be you. Well, thanks. I think I'll pass. This is Fresh Air. Buster Keaton, the great film comic, was born 100 years ago today in Pickaway, Kansas, during a cyclone. He was born into a vaudeville family that worked with Harry Houdini, and by the time Keaton was 5 years old, he was a vital part of his parents' roughhouse act. He went on to make brilliant silent film comedies. Between the years of 1917 and 1929, he made 12 feature films and 30 or so short films. This year, Kino Video collected many of his films, including some never available before, in a video box set. On this centennial of his birth, let's hear Keaton tell a brief story about his birth and his nickname.
I was born with a tent show on a one-night stand in Kansas. My mother joined the show when I was 2 weeks old, and it was called the Keaton Houdini Medicine Show Company. And when I was 6 months old, we were in some little town, small hotel, and I fell down a full flight of stairs to the bottom. They come running up. I sat up, just shook my head and shook it off and didn't cry. So they knew I wasn't hurt. And Houdini says, "That was sure a buster," meaning a fall. My father said, "Well, that would be a good name for him."
Buster Keaton, an excerpt from an interview with film historian Kevin Brownlow from the documentary Buster Keaton, A Hard Act to Follow. The guitarist and composer Bill Frisell has written new music scores for a couple of Buster Keaton films. This is music Frisell composed for Keaton's film Go West. Music by Bill Frisell from his album Go West. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Kathy Wolf. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.